Jochen Kleinschmidt. He teaches at the Technical University in Dresden and is a security expert based in Germany and has a very distinct voice. And we're very happy to have him here finally. It took you a while. Roderick already said that you should come.
Thank you so much for having me. Dobroho ranku, good morning. And good to be back.
It is a thing. And we're very happy that on this anniversary and this commemoration day, because it's both, we have you with us. It is vitally important that we create some noise. It's not just enough that there are three foreign ministers giving interviews and going about at the UN and making the case, because they evidently are still not yet on board with real war production. What do you say are the three critical factors Western European nations should get ready for this year?
Well, they should definitely, and this has been said by the previous speakers as well, they should acquire a sense of urgency. Right now, what we're seeing is that there's still politics, European politics is still in a crisis management mode. The overall feeling is that the conflict is localized, and it is not. And that is the first thing I think European countries should start adapting to, because Putin, in his speech when he started, shortly before he started the war, he was not only talking about Ukraine. He was demanding that NATO put all their troops back to where they were in 1997. So really, the aims that Russia has in this war not confined to just Ukraine, and this is something that has been conveniently overlooked by European leaders and European publics over the last 2 years, as Ukrainians have done the fighting and dying and suffering. And I would say that would be my number one point that European leaders need to understand. This is not just about Ukraine. This is being fought in and over Ukraine right now. But this war has a wider aspect. And we've seen Russian saboteurs, as they call them, committing different acts of violence in different European countries. We've seen them threatening the Finnish border, for example. We've seen them smearing Stars of David on buildings occupied by Jewish people in Paris. We've seen, of course, the Tiergarten murder and so on and so on. We've seen all kinds of what Russians call active measures. And this hasn't yet reached the European political conscience. And that this is one integrated conflict scenario, that is what we need to get ready for.
It's good that you just highlighted the assassination, because essentially, obviously the British government tolerated to an extent at least and did not lash out sufficiently hard, as it seems, and many people here in the space have said so beforehand, when weapons of mass destruction on a small scale were used to assassinate people, because Novichok is a significantly dangerous and capable toxic substance. And in the Tiergarten, Berlin, Kangushvili, simply was shot twice with a Glock by someone who had been sent. And now it seems that the destiny of Evan, the reporter from the Wall Street Journal, is dependent on a triangle, quite a ringtausch, if you so like, because Russia demands the exchange of the journalists against that specific assassin. What on earth should the West do in order to stop this cycle? Because since the days when Germany started appeasing the Ulbricht and Honecker regimes by paying for the souls coming out of Bautzen, we seem to be tolerating this.
Yes, we seem to be tolerating this. We even seem to be encouraging it because, as already George Kennan realized in his famous first in the Long Telegram and then in his classic Foreign Affairs article on the sources of Soviet conduct back at the beginning of the Cold War, Russia basically does whatever it can afford to do. It pushes where it feels no resistance, and thereby, by showing weakness by not sanctioning this behavior, we're encouraging more of it. And as we saw in the assassination of the Russian helicopter pilot who had alerted to the Ukraine side in the war in Spain, we are getting more of it. We're getting more targeted killings. We're getting more terrorist-type events. We're getting more active measures. And we're still not closing, for example, the Russian house in Berlin, which we could obviously easily do. It is still functioning as a center for Russian propaganda and as a cover for Russian covert activities. We're not closing it. We're not giving Russians the counter pressure that would make them stop this kind of activities. And that is something I have a very hard time understanding right now, the way things are.
Well, do you, or are we just saying this sarcastically and ironically because we both know that Mr. Mürzenich is all too happy that there is now the BSW with Ms. Wagenknecht mopping up those who are disaffected, disenchanted, so he can create yet another coalition which will be appeasing Russia?
Oh, you're opening up an interesting question here, the new Russian submarine in German politics. Actually, we don't know yet. We don't have any solid results on where the voters for Ms. Wagenknecht, or as we call her in Germany, Ms. Zarenknecht, where they are coming from. But yes, they will inevitably mop up some of the pro-Russian SPD votes. But as we've seen in recent polling, the voters of the SPD are not nearly as pro-Russian as, for example, Mr. Mürzenich, whom you've highlighted, I think, justly. If you look at his blog series that he publishes at the IPG Journal, you will see that what he has in mind, really, for the future of Europe and the world is a very retro-realistic, great power and spheres of influence-based type of geopolitics that is actually intellectually quite close to the discourse of Vladimir Putin, or at least some of his discourse. And you see that also with other social democrats in other areas of the world, such as Lula, that really internally they are somewhat progressive, but externally they fall back to this 19th century concert of power type politics, quite regrettably.
Mackinder.
Really. Mackinder, yes.
Yeah, they're going full Mackinder Heartland theory, simple solutions for simple people.
And it's all thought of in terms of geographic zones of influence, which is really not how the contemporary world is moving. If you look at how, for example, the US and China are interacting in the technological sphere, where it's much more about who controls which nodes on the technological networks which integrate our world, we're really not living in the world of Mackinder anymore. Actually, even Mackinder wasn't really living in the world of Mackinder as
he was probably wrong and outdated when he came about. I agree with you.
Yes, he was actually there was, if you read the transcript of his discussion at the Royal Geographical Society, then he was asked by an audience member, Leo Amery, what about the airplane? And he was like, oh, the airplane will never really be a factor in military affairs. Now, well, we all know how that went. So there is this what I call retrofuturistic realism, this tendency to project ourselves back into this macho age of power-based geopolitics. And that is really a macho world that never really has existed. And I think perhaps gender theory or feminism could say more about these ideas than actual people who work on security studies or grand strategy or anything like it.
I think this is, I'm an equal opportunity offender. There are men and women equally stupid in that regard who follow such people, because it's so simple. It is so stupid. It has so little base. In fact, you just highlighted the competition between the United States and China as in terms of technology. The race towards garnering rare earths, the find now just in the US, which will secure pretty much the next century in terms of harnessing at least two key elements of the rare earths, is probably more important when it comes to securing freedom for materials which are vital for the future of this planet, and but also competition of the systems, one authoritarian, one market liberal democracy, than many of the other discussions. So, but when you look at this, we contrasted it the whole day. We started at midnight with Volodymyr Omelyan, former Minister of Infrastructure in Ukraine, who volunteered on the 24th, 2 years ago, right away. He called upon a friend of his, a general in the ZSU, who was not so happy about what was going on. It was a bit more gloomy and doomy. He said, well, I have to do something, I'll volunteer. Went into the ZSU, has been there since the very days as a logistics officer, close behind the lines and at the front lines and fighting. We started with him and General McRyan. And both had a fantastic discussion in that regard. And McRyan boils it all down to one thing, and that is the leadership. That the leadership in the West has not been able to muster the will, has not been able to galvanize by good communication the will of the population, and therefore fails to formulate a strategy for victory. And if you do not have a strategy for victory because you do not have the will behind you, which you haven't formed, then of course you can't execute. Is that really everything there is to it?
Well, it might not be everything there's to it. There's many different factors influencing here, but I absolutely agree with what General Ryan has said. We don't have the leadership at the moment which is giving us a realistic appraisal of the overall threat situation. Instead, we're still in this crisis management mode. And there are antinomies in the discourse, for example, of the German leadership, which first thing declared that there would be a Zeitenwende, like a catastrophic sea change in which everything would be working differently from before, but at the same time is maintaining the sense of a normalcy, like we're managing this crisis in order to enable everyone to do as they had been doing before. And there's also this wide gap between the German government essentially selling this idea of bringing Putin to back down eventually, as if he were following some sort of liberal rationality, which he is evidently not. And, the gap between this and the actual reality of Putin's logic is quite drastic, so to speak. And yes, I would say the core task for governments right now is to close the gap and awake their countries to the size of the challenge that lies before us. Or as Hans Morgenthau once said, government should be the leader of public opinion, not its slave. And that is really something that we're not seeing right now.
A very good point, and interesting that you quote Morgenthau in that regard, because evidently it fits the purpose. Yesterday, in the video published, the discussion I think may have happened yesterday morning, or may have happened actually the day before, I'm not so sure. David Cameron, Radek Sikorski, and Annalena Baerbock jointly were interviewed on a panel at the Wall Street Journal because as they traveled to make their case to the United Nations and participate there. And Annalena Baerbock spoke about exactly this topic that she said that, well, we have to lead, it's our job to lead, and it's, so to say, we have to lead the population and formulate that. Now, that's fair. But then again, at the same time, she, both in the example of Ukraine as well as Israel, where she was very much focused on, together with David Cameron, on only one thing, stop the war. It was only about stopping the war. This is all about finding a ceasefire. At no point in time did she take the word victory. She implied it once, and she once integrated it into a sentence, but it was not about equipping Ukraine to defeat Russia. She spoke about the fact that she, and David Cameron actually gave her this by highlighting that she had confronted Lavrov at the G20 dinner. Now, that's interesting that you sit with the Lavrov for dinner and then you have a discussion there at the meeting and highlight to him that this is it's shameful and that everybody is supposedly now agreed as opposed to 2 years ago. And she was very happy about the fact that now everybody agrees that the Russian narratives are not dominating the discussion around the table. Okay, that in itself isolated could be seen as progress. But at the same time, 2 years ago, Western intelligence had already been banging the drum for at least 15 years about Putin's aspirations. We know since Condoleezza Rice made it public in 2008 what to think of this. There was a reason why Condi was pushing for Ukraine and Georgia to be given what was then the membership action plan path forward, which the Europeans prevented from occurring. It was Germany and France who made the stumble. So it makes me think, it seems that the German government definitely does not want to fight. It does not want to go onto a war footing. It, as you described, wants to make sure it does a bit of support. And our colleague Beefeater, I read this out right before you came, put it out today yet again as a from an analysis point of view that the language of support is the language of defeat. Which politicians do we need to lead us?
Well, I can't really tell you what politicians we need to lead. It might be the same we have today. It doesn't really matter, but they need to acknowledge that we're in a system competition. This war is something that we need to win, that Ukraine needs to win. And we need to acknowledge that for that to happen, we need to change the way we do business. We need to obviously have consequential sanctions. We need to fully disintegrate Russia from global capitalism. We need to move faster in that direction, much faster than we have been doing. And of course, we need to put our defense industries on a war footing. We need to, right now, the Bundeswehr has ammunition for just a few days of combat. That is not a sustainable situation, especially since we also have to supply Ukraine at the same time. We are still, this was true at least like a week ago, we are still exporting 155 millimeter howitzer ammunition to third countries, which I think impossible. We are not sending them to Ukraine or using them to bolster our own stocks, but we're exporting them as if we're in any kind of normal peacetime situation, which is simply not the case. That is an attitude that absolutely needs to end. We need to recognize the urgency. We need to recognize that we're in an emergency situation, and we need to act accordingly fast.
Who received the most modern IFV first in Europe? And Hungary.
Hungary, yeah.
I think on that day when you and I saw this, I presume we both were just face palming because it's insane to
yes.
think about it.
Yes, it is insane. We're actually we're giving away our most innovative military technology to a close ally of Russia and China. If you look at the security agreement that Orbán has concluded with the People's Republic of China, we're looking at a very problematic actor here, to say the least. And we're giving away our military technology there as if there was nothing wrong with it. That is, of course, a brutal irony in the face of the situation we're looking at.
And we should highlight this, because if a government is infiltrated, one of the key aspects which people often forget is how governments can easily attain information about what goes on in a factory, and that is environmental protection. It is audits, regular checkups, workplace checkups, and the likes. And you just need to infiltrate those kind of teams in order to gain more data, photograph, and infiltrate, in addition to, of course, bribing people in the process. So that Rheinmetall operates some of its most important explosive factories in Hungary is fine, because the explosive, that's not really high tech. The high tech is created somewhere else. So it's a necessary part of the supply chain. But that we are giving Hungary now four Gripen, fortunately they're old by comparison, they're current technology, they're not what is being developed. But the fact that the Swedes now have to think about what they're going to deliver to the Hungarians, so the knowledge does not go to the Russians, with whom they may be in conflict with their Swedish Air Force in future. And what they don't want the Chinese to know, because Orbán will sell it to them, and the Chinese and the Russians will infiltrate the Hungarian bureaucracy. Even if Orbán were to lose the next election, the infiltration will have happened. They will still be there for some time. So we are now giving away weapon systems and know-how. And at the same time, people in Germany are saying, oh, we can't give the Taurus because, oh, we would give away the weapon and we would not have a weapon. They haven't detected all that kind of bullshit. Fabian was kindly dissecting this beforehand here on our space when we went through the fact that nobody needs German soldiers to operate the Taurus. That's just absolute hogwash. I mean, neither South Korea nor Spain do need German soldiers. German soldiers went to Spain to train Spaniards, yes. Korean soldiers and Korean personnel went to NBDA and worked with the German Bundeswehr to work on procedures and processes, but they do not need them. They don't need Olaf Scholz or any former German general to sit around in Korea to press the button and authorize strikes. It ain't happening. Otherwise, you couldn't export it. But we've given this away, haven't we?
Yes, of course, absolutely. And all of those different rhetorical elements that are being used to deny Taurus are paradox and are, of course, I mean, we always accuse Russia, correctly, of using post-truth argumentation strategies. But when you look at those rhetorical strategies which are used to deny Ukraine essential weapon systems, the same argumentation techniques are getting used. You see this, these antinomies, things that can't be true at the same time, right? The government is saying at the same time, Taurus will not help Ukraine very much. At the same time, they're also saying Taurus will change the situation so much that there might be a nuclear retaliation from Russia. Well, only one of those two things can be true at one time. In fact, neither are true. So post-truth is something that we don't just find with autocratic governments. It's something that is present in the governmental discourse in our own countries, which is really quite worrying if you think of it.
As always, antinomies are used by those who are intelligent enough to obfuscate the game for those who are lazy enough to follow.
Exactly. Very well put. Yes. And I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking about the fact that I read the interview earlier in parallel to our sessions, and we've been, the whole team has been here since midnight. Some of us had a few hours of sleep in the meantime as well, but still, when I woke up, the first thing I saw that was even prior to a cup of coffee was the indication that the interview with Sarah Wagenknecht, Zarenknecht, would be published. Then it came up at 9:20 my time, which is 8:20 German time. The interesting thing is, of course, that she goes exactly through what you just described. She still portrays narratives, both Russian narratives, as well as very hardcore old school German socialist narratives, narratives of the peace movement. There's an inkling of no Atomstrom in my own home. She, however, at the same time deplores the high energy cost Germany has. And at one point in time in this interview, and we have Konrad will join us here later today. So Konrad Schuller from the Frankfurt Allgemeine Zeitung and the editor who's been on this interview with a colleague will be with us to discuss it. Of course, she refers to the Tucker Carlson interview and saying that this is what we should take Putin for. I mean, this is what Putin says and we should only follow what he says. Interestingly enough, he says a lot more than that. But she highlights that Hungary's, in German, the word is Wirtschaftsdaten. It's a bit wider, it's ambiguous. She can always say, well, I meant this later. But she says that Hungary is better suited currently economically than Germany because we have committed so many grave mistakes. Now, it's true, many grave mistakes have been done in Germany when it comes to energy prices, energy mix, and the like. Yes, no question, absolutely. And it's deplorable. This coalition has done grave, has committed grave mistakes in that regard, shutting down three of the most advanced and best kept and best maintained nuclear power reactors at this point in time is insane. But then again, that's very German. Having said this, at the same time, Hungary had close to hyperinflation, is deeply indebted, has had no growth. The fertility of the population has been dropping. There is massive, massive outflow of capital. And Hungary needs now today deals, as you just said, between China and Russia to make progress. Hungary is not the lightning rod of economics in Europe. On the contrary, it is so depressed that it needs the money from the EU to be paid out so that it can tide itself over. Ms. Wagenknecht says so. That is an antinomy. But she tries to mix it up. And this is what we're facing. Why are we so incapable of dissecting this? Why are we not highlighting this? I don't see this much in German media that these interviews took place, which discloses, but at the same time, I also don't see many people decrying it. Are we so complacent?
We are complacent to a very large degree. And I also have the impression that many of the leading actors in public life, political parties, politicians, but also the commentariat, even people like us, perhaps, have said or thought or believed one thing or another over the recent years, of which were quite turbulent, and therefore are reluctant to really harshly question beliefs that are commonplace among the population. You also see this with the German opposition, since you mentioned energy policy. They are now criticizing the closure of nuclear power plants when they themselves made the decision on them being closed after the disaster in Fukushima. So we're seeing antinomies here as well. It's also that, I mean, there's this literature out there on the fire hose of falsehood as the principle of Russian information warfare, but it also applies to other strategies of post-truth discourse, right? There is so much of it, you can't simply dissect it all, because if you were to dissect every single piece of false information that actors like Ms. Zarenknecht put out there, you would be in a purely reactive mode. You would be reacting to their statements all of the time, which means that you would let them control the agenda. So you're really by actors using that kind of post-truth argumentation, they're putting you in a double bind. Either you just tolerate those falsehoods in the public sphere, or you are placed in a purely reactive position where you let your opponent control the agenda. And that is something that has been happening between Russia and the rest of the, or between Russia and the free world in the global public sphere, at least since Putin's speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007.
Yeah, it's interesting. And thank you for highlighting yet again. A, the antinomies, absolutely agree with you. I mean, German nuclear reactors have been under attack since the social liberal coalition allowed former, shall we say, heavy duty and filled with a lot of old national socialist cadres, German industry to assist the Russians in exploiting their gas fields at the end of the 1960s. And it comes in the Helmut Schmidt government, the end of the social liberal coalition, which then approved and pushed for another up of another 10% of dependency on Russian gas against better advice by Zbigniew Brzezinski under Carter still. And Ronald Reagan couldn't change it anymore. The interesting thing is that this constant long con, long strategy by the Russians to put Germany and parts of Western Europe into gas dependency was then concluded by Schröder and Merkel in two runs. The Fukushima disaster was just a pretext, as you know, because Ms. Merkel simply thought that she would otherwise lose the election and she would lose to the momentum and the polls to the Greens. It's astonishing how short-sighted, astonishing how uneducated and how strategically incompetent German policy has been. Benjamin Tallis, who will join us also later this evening, he and I did an interview 1.5 years ago here, and we talked about this at that point in time. And he's been writing prolifically on this and also now in Foreign Affairs, albeit there was a short article with Tony Hofreiter and the likes. But Benjamin had said it, that there is no strategic thinking in Germany. There is no culture of strategic thinking in the political class. And when there is no such culture, how should the will be formed?
Yes, I highly recommend Benjamin and his work on neo-idealism. He will be well known here, I guess. And also the article by Mr. Hofreiter, Mr. Kiesewetter and Ben, which is a great taking stock of that failure of German foreign policy. You could really say that German foreign policy has gone through three phases over the last 80 years. In the first phase, which was the Cold War, our strategy was determined by being divided and being the being NATO's frontline country, so to speak. So there was no need really for a grand strategy that was in any way independent of other countries. There was no need for strategic thinking. Then in the post-1989 years, we also didn't have a grand strategy. We were simply living in this end of history world where everything was defined by the final triumph of liberalism, mostly economic liberalism. And well, and now we're in this third phase where we would need a grand strategy because we have some room to act. We have actual choices to be made. Our strategy is not predetermined by having to face down Russia directly. That is something being done by Ukraine right now. But definitely Benjamin and Mr. Kiesewetter and Mr. Hofreiter are correct. We need to start thinking in strategic terms. We need to design a grand strategy that takes those challenges seriously. And that implies letting go of this economic determinism and this narrow rationalism that made us believe that Putin would evaluate choices precisely the way that that we do. So yes, it's really a very timely article, and thank you for highlighting.
Yeah, it's interesting because Roderick was here and spoke with us. Benjamin has been here, will return today. The only one, the trifecta who we're missing is Tony Hofreiter, but I'm quite sure we will have his Bavarian accent soon with us. But interestingly enough, and thank you for highlighting the interregnum or the netherworld, the grey zone years of 1989 till, or 1990, you could even say, to 1998, because in those years, many decisions were made. People started to consume the peace dividend. The drawdowns in Britain started to destroy the British, or both the British say army as well as the Royal Air Force. This went all across Europe. Helmut Kohl was clinging to power, and I've always said this, and you may disregard it, you may just put it aside as an anecdote or something simple, but if it hadn't been for Wolfgang Schäuble being attacked and put into a wheelchair, we probably would have seen a completely different momentum and chancellorship in the 1990s and a different setup in Germany, and somebody who probably would have thought a little bit more about transatlantic and security matters other than the people who followed him. What do you think? Is that a crucial? Is this assassination attempt, which went awry by someone supposedly crazy, is that the crucial moment?
Oh, I personally don't think so. It might have been. I mean, of course, you could construct a historical counterfactual. What if, right? What would have happened if Mr. Exactly. Schäuble had been? That's a great book, by the way. Do get it if you have the chance. But I don't think politics are necessarily tied in that way to personalities. And even Mr. Schäuble could not have realized all of his strategic promise had he become chancellor at some point. At the same time, we should, I mean, even under the Kohl administration, there were some demonstrations of still some attempts at strategic action. If you look at, for example, Germany being the first country to recognize the independence of Croatia and Slovenia, where really there was some signs that Germany could try to shape the situation in southeastern Europe, in that case, in a way that favors a more politically understood liberalism. But that courage went away very quickly. Right? And I think something that played an important role here were the neo-Nazi attacks that cost many lives in the 90s that led to acts of brutality in different areas of Germany. And that situation sort of led to this narrative that economics über alles, right? People need to be seen as consumers and consumption wishes need to be satisfied at all costs. Otherwise, they will immediately turn into dangerous neo-Nazis. That was, of course, a very problematic narrative, but it's one that is still shaping German politics to this day in certain ways and is leading to this problematic position on many issues, including, of course, Ukraine.
Absolutely. Jochen, thank you so much for this. And please do stay with us because this is the perfect moment to tie in what we were discussing before and the many, many gullibles, the many people who have been corrupted and infiltrated in the Russian narrative seeded in the West, which then lead to both people who are foreign controlled assets and who should actually, in America, you would say they should go under FARA, but most of whom, as part of both the active measures as well as just generally the exploitation of weaknesses, have become what our friend Pekka Kalianiemi calls the Vatniks. And let me just recognize and welcome Pekka.